Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
And actually, I'm going to mute you until I'm done with the intro, so you can just hang tight for me. All right. Welcome to It's Who You Know. This is your host, Michelle W. Machen. My guest today is Rabbi Joshua Fenton, known to his friends and to all of us as Yoshi. In 2015, he was hired as the founding executive director of Studio 70, a Jewish learning laboratory. Studio 70 is a home of the Ada After School Program, the Jewish Learning Innovation Corps, and they've just launched a new national conference focused on part-time and after-school learning called Voices from the Field. All right, welcome to the program, Yoshi.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
Awesome. So as I mentioned, I had the privilege of coming and experiencing your center and was so blown away. I knew I had to have this conversation with you and all of the work that you've done in experiential and after school programs. So I want to just kind of start from the beginning, although I kind of outlined it for you a little bit in your own words of how you got into this position, how you got into this work, and what is it about this that's fueled your career?
Sure. Wow. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of little ones. Studio 70 is the organization that we created 5 years ago. When I say we, there was an advisory board to the ADA after school program at the time. It was fiscally sponsored by a local nonprofit, and this really amazing, innovative, local new model, really pioneering what we now refer to as the after school, the Jewish after school movement. And the time had come for not just significant growth, but a real embracing of almost a mandate or the charge to take this new approach to supplemental Jewish learning and share it, not just the model, but all of the components to it, and in particular, the special way in which we think about and construct learning experiences in ADA. The time had come for us to share that with the larger Jewish world. So I was hired to form this organization, to house ADA, to move it towards sustainability, to launch the fellowship program you mentioned, the Jewish Learning Innovation Corps, and to begin building what we at Studio 70 refer to as an improvement infrastructure, a new set of programs and activities and voices contributing to a renaissance in the part-time, supplemental, after-school, Sunday and religious school learning space. I mean, it's ironic. I write about this and I speak about it. You know, there are 400, 500, it's really, nobody knows how many youth learners are in this supplemental space. And the reason why is because there are so many of them in so many places throughout the country. Counting is just impossible. And folks have tried, you know, they get to, you know, Napa Valley or Chattanooga, Tennessee, or somewhere in Skokie, and all of a sudden they realize that, you know, there were all these schools and programs and initiatives they had no idea of. And they have to go back and start counting again. And I was speaking with some folks from a university back east who often do this work, and they were hired to count the number of youth learners in the part-time space. And this was in 2012. And they got, they were somewhere in the South and they were in, you know, the high 200,000s, and it became clear the charge was too great. All of that just to say, it is almost certainly the most populous learning space for grade school learners in North America, and at the same time, certainly the least resourced. And so what we are trying to do in our own little way is contribute to a growing demand for professionalization and appreciation, seeing that manifest in funding and resource allocation for the synagogue schools and the JCC programs and the independent programs and the Sunday schools and the Hebrew schools and so on. That's the long sort of winding road to why we made Studio 70 and what we've been trying to do with it since then. Yeah, you asked how did I come to this?
Yeah.
I am a really big believer in and lover of learning. Just the feeling of synapses being formed, new knowledge or skills being acquired, or even just deeper understandings being reached. It just feels great. As a child, I loved it. As a teen, as an adult. And when I speak with students, everybody knows what I mean. The process of getting there, school and education and class, that's a different story. But the feeling of learning, everyone loves it. And so from even before I went to rabbinical school, I've always been oriented towards education as a career, and in particular, alternative approaches to learning. Up until the formation of Studio 70, I'd always worked out of larger central agencies. And they were always wonderful opportunities to impact a lot of different learners, educators, schools, and all sorts of different areas. When the idea for the formation of what we call Studio 70 first brought to me, I saw it as a chance to build something really new for the field. Historically, I had always focused on capacity building work. That's so gratifying. And at the same time, the distance that I felt between the ultimate beneficiaries of the work we were doing was just too great. And so Studio 70 gave me the space to reimagine Jewish learning for youth according to what I know kids are looking for and really need after school.
If you could just focus for us a little bit on specifically the after school program that you run. What's the structure? How does it work? What's the experience that kids have when they come to your facility?
Sure. Well, EDA is an after-school program we run here in Berkeley and with a satellite in San Francisco. It's a five-day-a-week, what we call full-service after-school program. And what that means is Monday through Friday, beginning at around 1:45, children start arriving to EDA. For as many kids as possible, we coordinate their transportation, whether that's working with the local school bus system or other sort of Uber for Kids programs that we work with. Over 70% of the children that come to EDA are transported directly from school using some program or system that we coordinate. We get them to EDA when they arrive. We focus on what we call a soft landing. Essential to our approach to after school engagement is the belief that what kids need most after school is to not go to school. And at the same time, we know that what that means for so many of them is finding space to stretch, literally and figuratively,
right,
to exercise control, agency, make choices for, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. They have to sit and raise their hand and stand in line, and it's just exhausting for them. So when they get to us, what we focus on is creating a really provocative and exciting space and set of learning experiences that they can not only choose from, but that feel to them to be anything but school. And so, practically speaking, EDA for the educators out there looks something like a big learning center. There are a variety of different stations. All of the stations are designed according to the different curricular focus. Each of the stations focuses on a different sort of modality of learning. Each of them has a different set of goals and outcomes. And the kids spend, our earliest arrivals, our kindergartners begin arriving at around 1:45, and we have children rolling into the space for another hour and a half afterwards. At around 3:15, 3:30, everyone is in. Hey, duh. Everyone has bounced around to different stations. They've been modeling and designing in our makerspace, or they've been grabbing something to eat in our Hebrew immersive Misada, the restaurant we run every day where we serve a warm meal. They've been climbing around on our play structure or climbing wall or making an art project or practicing their Hebrew reading in our Sifriya, engaged in our learning center, our listening center. And they are negotiating their experience for themselves. So when Sarah or Brian or Julie or whomever, you know, comes to Ada and they've just had a really long day and they need to crash it on the couch and read a book or play checkers or whatever, you know, there is space within the program and the model for that as well. All our teachers are trained in nonviolent communication, and we believe really strongly in that lens as an essential tool to really meet youth learners where they are at that particular time of day specifically. And that kind of combination, designing really exciting learning spaces, making them look nice and provocative and inviting, and then allowing the kids to choose how they spend their time in this immersive experience. It's almost like a big installation, you know, is really what Ada is all about. Right. That goes on for a little over 2 hours. And then the day sort of evolves into something that looks a bit more like a traditional camp program. We have an opening circle. We sing songs. We speak Hebrew. There are a variety of questions that we focus on in our different ma'agalim in the circles that we have. And they're all highly curated. We talk about the weather and the calendar and how we're feeling and the time of day. And each mini conversation in our different circles is scripted, is introducing very specific vocabulary, and all of our kids are evaluated in that little mini program. So for 15 minutes each day in circles, in addition to the Hebrew language learning that they're doing in all of the stations, we also do lots of conversational work in our different circles. And again, this is just another approach to experiential Hebrew language learning that we're invested in. After all of that happens, it's around 4:15, and everyone has spent some time doing all the different things they want to do, and they've gotten something to eat, and our older kids have done some of their homework or grabbed a table to hang out with friends. Then we break everyone up into grade-specific groups. And we hit the peak of looking traditional at that moment in the day. We talk about most of Ada, the after-school program, being focused on skills and knowledge outcomes. In our Sifriya, in our library, everyone is on an individualized reading plan. So everyone's learning to read and write Hebrew, but according to their own pace. And we're evaluating them based on their ability to read and write, looking at mastery. Similarly, in our immersive restaurant space, there's a vocabulary list, there's a script, and we're checking their mastery over the very specific language learning goals of that station. Each station is either focusing on language goals and or some specific content, whether it's learning the weekly Torah portion in our Lego Bay Midrash or designing a machine that can tell you which Rosh Hashanah it is. Then in the afternoon, when we break them into grade-specific groups, that's when we do what we call our meaning-making. In each of the grade-specific groups, because they're grade-specific, the kids are able to engage in just deeper work, more thoughtful conversations about how the content makes them feel, what we call good questioning of the content. And what that means is asking why questions and what if questions and what came before questions and what would come after questions. And in focusing on the content in that way in the afternoon, not only do the kids have space to be making their own meaning, but we're really investing in creating a community of inquiry and welcoming all of the different Jewish experiences that this post-denominational 21st century Jewish community here in California is looking for.
And what are some of the reactions that you've gotten from people if this even happened, in synagogues that come and visit your center in terms of, you know, ways that they could be adapting their current programs to this? Like, do traditional people say, oh, this is just a unique thing, this could never work for us? Or they say, this is awesome, I could do this and that and adapt some of these principles and techniques? Like, what's the general sense that you get
sure.
from the rest of the community about what you've built?
Sure. When it comes to parents, I'll start with them because they're often the most amazed in that such a Jewish learning experience exists. I had no idea. We hear all the time. And by creating that kind of space, that kind of programming, and then messaging to parents, we do this 5 days a week. Figure out your schedule. At Eidah, we have a 2-day-a-week minimum. But all days are created equally. Figure out your schedule and know that we are a resource. We're not on Tuesdays and Thursdays or Mondays and Wednesdays such that you need to worry about soccer or ballet or play practice and will it coordinate, will it align.
Right.
What we say to families is we're not an extracurricular activity. We are community support. And once we flip that switch for parents, it transforms the relationship that they have with the program. No longer are we a burden or something to figure out how to get to. We plug holes. Most of our parents use the program more than they signed up for. So 2-day-a-week
right.
kids are always dropping in for a third day. 3-day-a-week kids are always dropping in for a fourth day. Those who are most impacted by the program and who have the strongest reaction are parents when they see it for the first time.
Right.
When professionals come to the program to visit, and we get a good amount of inquiries to tour and to see our curricula from synagogue educators, they initially try to find and talk through what everybody imagines are the resource challenges to implementing an Eidah-like program in their synagogue. I gave a talk at a conference not long ago of synagogue administrators and did my best to disabuse them of that. I think that every shul should be running this program. There are hundreds, thousands of synagogues throughout North America, largely quiet Monday through Friday. Without question, space is a huge expense. There are more and more dual income families in our community. There are more and more families living apart from extended family.
Right.
And after school care is a real pain point. You know, sometimes in the Jewish world, we adopt all of this jargon from, like, you know, the Harvard Business Review or wherever. Pain point is one of those, one of those terms. But this is a genuine pain point. The parents need care for their children.
Right.
And synagogues, historically, traditionally, are meant to play that role. I mean, we had the emergence of, you know, Mordechai Kaplan's vision of a JCC. You know, that too could be offering a similar kind of experience. And we speak to JCCs about this as well. But in general, educators across the board are enamored with the model. They're excited about the very particular program elements within it. And they have this general sense of there not being enough of whatever it is that they perceive to need in order to make this shift. We know in this space that parents are going to continue to send their kids to our programs. And the leadership in our communities are going to continue to encourage parents to sign their children up for Sunday school, you know, whatever the program, the local program is in their given communities and synagogues and whatnot. And we at Studio 70 are trying to really scream from the rooftops and the Voices from the Field conference that we launched this last fall is part of this effort to really shine a light on the need to embrace this space as a legitimate and important domain in the Jewish community. There's Jewish camping and there's Jewish ECC and there are day schools and there's, you know, young adult programs. And there are hundreds of thousands of kids in kindergarten through fifth grade who are being told to go to all of these different schools, and all these schools are really left to figure it out.
Right.
People love it. They want it. And we're trying our best to bring it to them.
Right. You talk about pain points, and, you know, for me as a lifelong Jewish professional, I can say now in terms of my career so far, and as far as I see my career forever, I'm always looking for the excellent, right? And I pride my own work of saying, you know, there is never, we've always done it this way, or there's no difference, we can do it, or, well, whatever, if they don't like it, right? That's never just the way that I've operated. And so it's always a pain point for me in terms of seeing, you know, religious school programs that there's isn't this desire to look at something. And even if it's, you know, obviously you can't create a whole new center with things that are there all over the time. If you have a preschool and you have other programs going on, you have basically a community center within your congregation. But there's so many wonderful nuggets there in terms of experiential education in the classroom, right? Times where you don't have to have everything be frontal learning in order for learning to happen. And I can't stand it when parents or professionals use the mantra of, oh, well, I did religious school and I hated it, but I did it and I had my bar mitzvah and therefore you're going to do it and you're going to hate it and that's just the way it is, right? Like, there's nothing worse in my soul that pains me more than to hear something like that. And the sense that I get from your kids is, I doubt that there's anyone, and maybe there is, who knows, but kids in your program that are like, oh, like, I have to go to ADOT today, like, oh, I really don't want to, right? They see it as their home. They see it as a safe space, a fun space, a place with their friends, right? That encompassed within this building of a strong Jewish identity. I think too many people are resigned to being like, yeah, religious school sucks. It's learning. It's school. It's, you know, you have to learn Hebrew letters, and that's just the reality of what it is, and you're just going to hate it. And it just irks me. I can't accept that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, well, it's totally unacceptable. It's insanity. I had this traumatic experience, therefore you too should have this traumatic experience. Right. And then we will be furthering the Jewish community and Hitler will have not won.
Right.
So absolutely. And parents definitely respond to that, as do professionals, as do funders. But mostly it's the kids. At Studio 70, we talk about fun as a metric. Right. We are right. Not school, and we believe that learning new things is fun. Therefore, they should be doing both.
Yeah.
And if ever it's true, sometimes we have to, you know, we've got to incentivize Eli to spend 15 minutes practicing his Hebrew reading, but we do so in all sorts of fun ways. And when he's engaged in the activity of, you know, practicing his reading or working with his friend on it. While the transition might be a little bit, might require some external motivation, the experience itself is always a pleasurable one. If the kids are not having fun, if the staff are not having fun, if Eda is not a joyful place, then we're doing it wrong. And we stop doing whatever it was that wasn't meeting that goal. It's a funny way to approach education for those of us who think of learning as sitting in a desk and receiving information from a teacher who bestows it, who gives it over to us.
Right.
But when learning is understood as an experience of discovery and exploration, when my imagination is a necessary component and my physical engagement is required, all of a sudden, learning is what I do in my life everywhere. I'm always learning about different things, even Hebrew language. We at Eda focus in very intentional ways on encouraging passive language skills amongst the kids. And so, you know, we speak to them in Hebrew, and we want to see that they understand how to respond. We know that they can't possibly translate all of the Hebrew that we speak to them, but we measure their comprehension of the ideas. It's even deeper than exposure. I mean, it's a genuine understanding. So when someone raises their hand and says, "Od chamesh dakot lavsaka," you know, they couldn't translate half those words, but they know exactly what it means. And that's the same way that they learned English when they were children.
Right.
That's how people learn. And when you focus on creating learning experiences that are sort of, that feel natural and are experiential, almost organic to them just existing in the room, it's a different learning experience for them. It is joyful Jewish learning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a tagline we used to use and have since abandoned, but it's really true. It's right. joyful Jewish learning because it's not all of those other things that schools are and really shouldn't be.
Right. Well, it's also, it seems like your program is very adaptable to different learning styles, right? So I think that's something that when you have such a smaller program with not trained teachers, right, you're kind of hiring religious school teachers that say yes, as opposed to people who are skilled, because it's a difficult position to fill. And you have a kid that has, you know, maybe some behavioral issues or maybe some learning differences, or is a really visual learner and somebody else who's a very auditory learner. And to then say, all right, we're all going to sit here and watch this video for 10 minutes of silence, right? You're not really capturing as much for each of these kids what kind of experience they'd like to have. And I like the idea that, you know, half of your program at the beginning part of your program is this mixed grade aspect to it, right? That it's not this, you know, kind of segregated thing, that we're a community. And I think a lot of times that community aspect could be missing from secondary education in this
That's way. Right. Yeah, I mean, when we think about the agenda, you know, what are we trying to achieve through the Jewish Learning at EIDA? We are creating the next generation of community. You know, and so EIDA needs to reflect not even what is, but what we hope will be. Mm-hmm. And it's why we focus on Hebrew language. We know that for adults, Hebrew language is one of the biggest barriers to engagement in Jewish life. It doesn't matter if our graduates grow up to become religious or secular, if they never want to set foot in the synagogue again because their theology is so complicated they just can't do it, or if they love JCCs or if they make Aliyah, whatever it is, we want them to feel entirely comfortable and equipped to create whatever Jewish life they want to create for themselves. And we embrace, both through our curriculum and also through our staffing, we embrace the vision
right.
of a truly diverse Jewish community. And our staff reflect that. It's pretty special in that way. Secular Israeli educators and very religious Dati Orthodox educators from, you know, from the East Coast, and camp folks and ECE folks and educators who've, you know, primarily worked with special needs learners. You know, we bring everybody onto the team and say, you look like what we want Jewish community to look like.
Right.
And you're going to help us form an EIDA that is, you know, a microcosm of the bigger community, but, you know, the expanded upon version of our professional community.
Right.
What I will say about, you know, you mentioned staffing, and something that's really important about the 5-day-a-week model, and this is, EIDA is not the only 5-day-a-week after school program in North America. There are a number of them in cities, including DC and Atlanta and Philly and Chicago and Boston, Toronto. We all work together as part of a network called Nitzan. That's an aside. But what happens is when you have a 5-day-a-week program that runs for 4 or 5 hours in the afternoon every day, all of a sudden you're hiring people who are staff, who are salaried positions, who are 50% time, 75% time. And it's no longer a bunch of contractors who are, you know, being spoon-fed, you know, some content, given a lesson plan, and they go and they teach it for an hour.
Right.
We have a staff who thinks carefully, long and hard about the experiences of all the kids every day. It also allows us to talk about every child every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an after-school program, and so their social and emotional needs and growth are critical to us. And by running a bigger business with children coming more often, we have to staff up for that. And what that brings, in addition to everything we've already talked about, are more smart people thinking about the program
right.
for longer times. It's difficult to quantify how impactful that is, but it's certainly felt.
Right.
Not just in the program itself, but also in terms of who we can recruit for staff people. You know, these are real jobs. We offer
right.
we offer all of our employees who are half-time or more full health benefits. And And while that's a significant expense, what it says to our staff is, we take your work really seriously. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the year, we do a tech study about the difference between taking your work seriously and taking yourself seriously. You know, we aspire to not take ourselves too seriously, but right. to take the work very seriously. And the model, distinct from, in my opinion, everything else that's happening in the supplemental world, of which there are many, many shining lights.
Right.
The 5-day week model professionalizes the experience of educators in a way that other part-time approaches can't.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So you've been doing this for about 5 years now, and I'm curious in terms of you'd mentioned a tagline that you no longer use, and I want to just kind of hear, you know, what else did you either like expect at the start that totally changed, or that you kind of had to adapt and learn from over these last 5 years in terms of either making changes to the program, or like when you first started, you really didn't expect this to happen, and it has, any kind of learning that you've sure. had yourself in running this kind of a place over the last 5 years?
So many learnings about organizational growth, about scaling programming, about funding. And, you know, we're in what some, to use some more jargon, refer to as the mezzanine stage of organizational growth, you know, and mm-hmm. sort of all of the challenges that come along with that. You know, I think that what we are excited to do is to bring this to more and more children, to more and more families. We believe that the market for this sort of program is huge. And we've been working hard to increase our capacity to do that. And what that's meant, what that's required of me, is to really get clear on what is essential to the model. Because with each new director and each new ADA comes a new flavor of the after-school program. Mm-hmm. The ADA in San Francisco feels different than ADA in Berkeley. And you know, and the same goes for the programs in the greater DC area or in Atlanta right. or in Philly. And so for me personally, my staff knows I really like for them to decide. And I also have a lot of opinions.
Yeah, that's good.
And I also joke with them, the two notes that I have in my pocket are slow down and hurry up. You know, and so, I mean, what I've had to learn is really think about what's essential, and what I've come to understand is that what's essential to the model is a focus on real experiential learning, a deep commitment to meeting the needs of youth learners after school, and an internal promise, an organizational promise, to be in a constant state of reflection. Because, you know, when we're dealing with so many kids coming directly after school, different days of the week, so much variability, and we're committed to an experiential, emergent approach to learning, while we have a high tolerance for failure, there's a lot of dynamism and moving parts. And we have to be really self-reflective and embrace feedback and embrace critique in order to continue to grow, because the program has to be dynamic and sort of elastic in that way.
Right.
I've come to embrace each of our different directors' personal passions and foci, and as staff turn over every few years, a program, you know, we might have a less robust makerspace because Itai is no longer with us and our right. art room is really taken off. These are the ways in which our community evolves, as do all communities. And so, you know, really committing to those three principles. And then, you know, educationally speaking, you know, we at ADA, we believe in the power of language. I personally just, I love language. I love books. I love the feeling of access that it brings. And so for the ADA after school program, Hebrew language will always occupy a central place. And the model can certainly exist in Boulder, Colorado, where it's exclusively focused on skiing.
Right, right. That's awesome. That's so great. Wonderful. So, you know, as we kind of wrap things up, you know, and kind of thinking about your own life and opening new centers and, you know, running a successful business steeped in Jewish education and experience and growth. How do you keep yourself from not hurrying too fast and not slowing down too slow? How do you keep that
That's
balance?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's a great question. I'm still working on it. I mean, I think over time, I've come to really appreciate seeing the things that I've built last and not needing anything externally to be filled up with good feelings because of those things. In rabbinical school, you know, you remember these sort of random aphorisms, but my teacher, Rabbi Brad Artson, he said, he probably wouldn't remember ever saying this, but I remember, he said, you can do all sorts of amazing things if you don't care who gets the credit. And it's taken me some time to understand the truth of that.
Right.
But I get it now. And I would just, I share that with, you know, with anyone else sort of coming up in the Jewish communal world, education in general.
It's a good lesson for a rabbi.
Yeah, right. No, but it's really, I mean, it's, there's seeing the Silicon Valley Jewish Music Festival. I remember being at a meeting a few years ago and hearing people talk about it and sort of wonder, when did it ever start and how did it ever become? And of course, I know the story, but
right.
It was so gratifying that this program that we created now simply exists as part of the fabric of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't need anyone to pat me on the back or to say, oh, you know, Yoshi, blah, blah, blah. So I guess I would say those experiences are out there. And if you really focus on the learners, on the people you're trying to connect to, on the community and can let go of, you know, the trappings of ego that sometimes hold us back, you know, there does come a time, you know, maybe you got to get to your 40s, but there comes a time where that kind of personal meaning and satisfaction, you know, is really found. And it's really through contributing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about building and investing in the quote unquote, I hate the word, but the institutions that make up our community, not the sacred cows, you know, but the spaces and the places and the activities that people are doing.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely. That's definitely a wonderful bit of advice that is really important to remember, especially in the work that we do. You know, nobody goes into Jewish communal work for the paycheck, sometimes for the glory, mostly not for the glory.
Right.
You know, there's something deeper that we're doing this for, and if that deeper is not enough, then we don't do it, right? Then we find something else to do. You know, learning, if Judaism, if education, if community, if these things aren't what drives your heart, then you're in the wrong field.
Right. More than 10 years ago, I facilitated a few panel discussions that asked the question, what could be the new Jewish narrative after a Jewish continuity narrative? No longer do the families at Eidah respond to send your children here so that the Jewish people can live on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, and so in the absence of that, what else motivates us?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we live in a really exciting and fortunate time as Jews to demand of our tradition more. And thankfully, wonderfully, you know, we are the inheritors of a rich religious and intellectual and literary tradition. Turn it over. There's so much in there. And I embrace that charge and that demand. And if it's ever not working for you, you know, pause, dig around a little bit, you know, and figure out what's not right exactly. Cause there is so much in there.
Right. Well, I love the framing that you had mentioned earlier in our conversation that, you know, get out of your mind that this is an extracurricular, right? This is a community building. This is something that's different. Cause I think the question is always to families, like, why, you know, what's the value add to our life in our child's life to participate in this, whatever this is, right? So if for a family, you know, making pancakes together on Sunday morning is more of a value add than, you know, coming to religious school on 8:30 a.m. when your kid is kicking and screaming because they don't want to go, they're going to ask themselves, why am I doing this, right? And the answer is no longer, like you said, the continuity of the Jewish people, right? Because if you don't, you know, Jews might not be around anymore. And we are living in a little bit of a different political climate, and hopefully, you know, this is not a political climate that will continue for much longer in our country, of just a little bit more fear about being being Jewish, I mean, publicly so. But the, you know, the Jewish text, the belonging to community, just because it's what you do as a Jew, that's just not, that's not a thing anymore. And it seems like what you've created and helped to create has really put that value added and answered that why very, very clearly. And I think that the parents and the kids and the community have clearly seen what you've done. And now for everyone else, the question is, all right, how do we possibly do something either like this or have this? And how do we, you know, compete with something like this when this is, you know, offered in the community? But really looking at that value add and saying, how do I create a program that kids are so excited to come to, that kids are, you know, growing their Jewish identity, growing their social connections, growing their community, proud to be Jewish in a wonderful way. And maybe they'll get a bar mitzvah, right? Maybe that end goal, sure, of standing on the bima and leading our community in prayer is, you know, is a valid goal, but all those things in between, all of that experience that they have, you know, it needs to be different than their parents, if their parents' experience was unpleasant. And the question is just, you know, how do individual communities create that? And so I think having something as successful as your model out there and available and ready with replication, and this new conference that you have, that possibly have another one for people to really share these ideas and find a way to spread it.
But just say, I mean, I think the question is not how, the question is when. You know, right. This space for so long has suffered from the misperception of scarcity. You mentioned competition, right? We're looking at it in the opposite way than we should. There are so many learners. The market is vast, and we have so many resources to tap into, despite not getting a lot of love from the federations and the foundations and so on and so forth. It's really a matter of, you know, when are we just going to take the plunge and do things differently? And I think, you know, we're seeing the after school movement, the Nitzan Network, you know, we certainly help with that. Studio70.org, you know, check us out. We can come help. But the URJ, the USCJC, everyone is trying so hard to continue growing and doing this thing that we do outside of school better. And maybe first among those in the community who need to really realize that are ourselves, to realize how much we've done, to realize how much we've already achieved, and let go of the fear of the pivot. I can't emphasize that enough. Fear can't drive us any longer. Fear of funding, fear of kids, fear of, you know, et cetera. You know, we need to start doing Jewish education
pivot, right?
The way we
sometimes
should.
Even thinking of a little tiny change or a little thing here or a pilot program there, like that's sometimes that's not even enough, right? Like just throwing it out and saying this year we're gonna do something totally different, right? And that needs to be okay. You know, that's
absolutely, it needs to be embraced. I mean, that's exactly right. And wonderfully, this is not Silicon Valley. This is Jewish education. Right. So we'd love to get you more professional development, and you should definitely go spend a month in Pardes, you know, over the summer. And so, you know, we're going to fire everybody and hire the next round of professionals.
Right.
And given that climate, it's incumbent upon those at the very top. I mean, the leaders of our communities to message that, let go of the fear, embrace change, and, you know, magical things can happen.
Yeah. And we're all the better for it always. Right.
Absolutely.
Well, I really enjoyed our conversation, and it was really a pleasure to talk to you. And I knew there was so much here that not only I knew I'd benefit from the conversation, but I know our listeners will love to hear about it. And thank you so much, Yoshi. I really appreciate you being on the program.
It was really nice speaking with you.
Liked this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com. or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.